Thank you. Yeah, so I changed a bit the title from what it was advertised, so that I can fit a few more of the things that I like in this talk. I'm not sure exactly how much of the biology you're familiar with. Basically, this is the central dogma of molecular biology. There's the DNA that you've heard encodes the genetic information for all kinds of things. The effectors, up to very recently, have been believed to be mainly protein molecules that do all the enzymatic functions in the cell. And from here to there, there's a number of steps that at some point were thought to occur in some linear fashion. So we have the DNA gets made into a pre-mRNA via transcription. There's a splicing process that removes parts of this pre-mRNA to generate a mature mRNA form. This is translated into protein. And I said something about RNA biology because basically the kind of things that I do relate mainly to these two processes here, splicing and translation, and they happen at the RNA level in the cell. As I said, this is the central dogma sort of generated a long time ago, actually, and it looked like a linear picture. It turns out that a lot of these processes are interdependent, interregulated. They don't, transcription and splicing are to some extent coupled. There's a lot of feedbacks, and there's been, aside from the protein effectors, at least in the recent years, a flurry of papers talking about RNA effectors. So this picture has changed a lot. Here's roughly the here are the topics that I want to address today. So first of all, as I said, I'll talk about two things, alternative splicing and small regulatory RNAs. And I'm going to go through these items one by one, and hopefully at the end I'll get into actually trying to couple these two things together. Many of you have been probably familiar with what has been happening in terms of genome sequencing, and in particular with the very big surprise that came with the sequencing of the human genome and the initial annotation showing that there's about 35,000 human genes, not even three times as many genes that as in Drosophila. So that surprise basically generated a very big drive to figure out how do we explain the difference in complexity between humans and flies if gene number apparently can't account for that. Yeah. No. Okay, so the first answer to that question was, well, actually the phenotypic diversity has something to do with transcriptome diversity, and when we're talking about transcriptome diversity, there are several different ways that diversity is generated, one of them being alternative splicing, and that's precisely what I'll talk about. Yeah. I presume, actually, I don't know how many genes plants have, but there have been a number of genome duplications, and I imagine that there are plants that have, they definitely have more chromosomes, but I don't know in terms of genes exactly how many they have. They're not animals. But yeah, so, I mean, obviously this is not, you know, we're not the epitome of complexity. That is, obviously a lot of these arguments had to do with semantics.
So, yeah, there is a lot of that technology.
Okay, so there's many ways in which we can generate, and the diversity is generated, and it's not really in the number of genes. So a few of these ways are, to start with, what seems to be the paradigm actually in animal transcription is that instead of having one mRNA produced from a particular piece of DNA, we can get many, many, one way being by starting at different places in the genome. So alternative transcription start sites and symmetrically at the other end, alternative termination can generate multiple mRNAs from the same piece of DNA. And why this is different? Well, there's some notorious examples, but the most typical one being that by starting transcription at a different place, there's a piece of mRNA that is missing from this transcript relative to this one, and that might be encoding actually what is in this case a transmembrane domain. So this is an example, known example of a protocadherin gene that has many many alternative forms which are generated by alternative transcription start sites. And in this particular case, you can see the two forms just differ by a transmembrane domain. And alternative splicing, which I'm going to talk about next, can also produce these kind of things where by incorporating or not a piece of mRNA in the mature mRNA, you can encode or not encode for a particular protein domain. So alternative transcription is one way of doing this. And upfront, I should tell you that computationally, we can't really tell alternative transcription start site, and we cannot predict alternative splice forms. We might be able to predict that there are transcription, multiple transcription start sites based on cross-species conservation. We're going to find more or less sort of the same promoter regions conserved across organisms, and the same holds for alternative exons. So pieces of the genome that are conserved, they should have some function, and we can maybe assign this kind of function depending on where they occur in the gene. Yes. Okay, so there's a lot of work in the field of what is called gene prediction that has to do with finding exons in the genome. I think probably the most successful tool in this respect has been GenScan, which has been developed by Chris Birch, and as I seem to remember that basically of the order of 80% of the exons that have some transcript evidence can be found in one way or another in the genome. Obviously, the exact boundaries of the exons are not generally predicted correctly, but some anchor in that particular exon you can get, so for about 80% of the exons. There's a lot of signals that go into that. It's splice signal, open reading frames, motif composition, things like pentamers. Nowadays, in principle, you could incorporate things like splice enhancers and silencers that people have figured more about in the recent years and so on. But the bottom line, yeah.
Let me make a comment on this. GenScan has been tested. I mean, this number you're citing, I think it's just for one organism, usually mouse or human. But I know that in other organisms, it really doesn't do so well. So if you just take GenScan, for example, and you run it saying the phenomenon genome.
Yeah, but it makes no sense to do that because, of course, GenScan has been trained with some parameter in some speed.
They're complicated things. It depends also how we teach it to the genome. Then it's maybe easier or harder to train using GenScan. And people have been, so there are new generations of it, there's a GenScan, but also things like GenScan.
Also, Chris Birch in the recent times has developed a version of it's called Genome Scan, I think, that includes conservation information aside from the single genome.
So my comment is nevertheless, so if you just take an arbitrary, say, animal genome and try to run without training data, it's usually for that it's not doing well. For example, the phenomenon genome, if you don't have training data, it's just most like all the people. So
Yeah, but I think this is a bit of an abuse of the tool because, as I said, there's a lot of parameters that go into it, and of course, if you run it with no training, you don't expect very much. Now you can say, well.
I was commenting on this question: how well can you just predicting exons and apparent this question without training data, and just using raw sequences? And you're saying in this case it's not so good.
That helps with all kinds of other, I mean, not just protein coding genes, but basically this. Okay, so as I said, I don't think we can, and basically everybody has reiterated this, you can't go very far with predicting genes, transcription start sites from the naked sequence. So the hope comes really from high throughput experimental techniques. And I'll just mention this one because I think it's actually very cool. Although, like with anything else, it has a fair amount of noise, and you have to collect enough data to actually get robust measures of transcription. But basically, how this works is, especially the Riken Institute has been very active trying to develop technologies to capture full length cDNAs that look like this. So this is basically you start with an mRNA with a poly A tail and a specific kind of structure cap that can be recognized by. You can mark it, you can recognize it. So you can try to pull down mRNAs that have both the poly A tail and the cap structure, and that indicates that you have picked up a full-length cDNA. And if everything went right, you know that this is the start site. So what they've done is to ligate particular sequences to the cDNA, and then they've used a specific kind of restriction enzyme that cuts a specified distance from a particular sequence pattern. So if this sequence pattern occurs in your linker, and then you cut a certain distance from that specific sequence pattern, you end up with these relatively short pieces that come from the beginning of mRNAs, and these are what they call cage tags. So the enzymes that they've used in this kind of procedure give sequences of roughly, I think, 18, 20 nucleotides long. They're not very long, so there's one problem with actually going back and mapping these things to the genome. You can get spurious mapping to different places, but they're just about so. From my own experience, when you try to map short sequences to the genome, if it's about 18 nucleotides long, that's when you start getting into spurious matching. So if you have something that is 20, 22, then you can, and if it has no errors, you can map it fairly precisely to where it came from. So now these things, they concatenate these pieces. They concatenate, construct these concatenomers, and these are going to be sequenced. And then once you obtain this longer sequence, you have to reverse the process, remove the linkers in between them, and then you end up with the sequence of the cage tags. Yeah.
So this technology, Does it matter if the mRNA is translated or to capture it? Because then it would be start for a single stop. So is there maybe a bias to get more just process genes on the way to the translation? Is there a way to use ribosomes and different designations and different elements of the cell?
Yeah, there's a million sources of bias in these things, and I mean, just from this process, right? So you capture the transcript based on the poly A tail, but of course you can do internal priming of the poly A's. But in this case, if you just look for the cache tag, probably doesn't matter. But if you talk about full-length cDNAs, it does matter. And then you have to prepare your library so that you don't get nuclear fractions, and because they designed the technology to capture as many unique cDNAs as they can, of course, then you enrich for rare variants. So if you really try to model this kind of thing to figure out the relative abundances of transcripts, it's just impossible. Okay, so now this procedure has generated, I think, I shouldn't make a mistake now, but of the order of about 7 million sort of cache tags per in things like mice and humans. So once you have these things, you can map them back to the genome, and you can figure out what transcription start site you have. So then you can start looking at the gene structure. You can start looking at what transcription factors bind upstream of the different transcription start sites, and what start to reconstruct these kind of regulatory networks that Eric Davidson was talking about this morning. So that was alternative transcription. And as I said, there's a similar amount of variation at the other end of the mRNA, basically at the termination step. I won't go into that, but that basically how you find this alternative termination site. You prime with a poly A, you get your EST, you map it to the genome, and now you have to figure out to basically distinguish between internal priming and real transcript termination. And there's some signals at the 3' end that are important for the 3' end processing that can help with that. They're not very precise, so it's some, again, noisy procedure, but you get some evidence of polyadenylation, and it looks like there is a lot. So I don't remember actually what's the most recent estimate in terms of how many genes have multiple transcription start sites or polyadenylation sites. When I've done the first analysis of this in mouse, I think we found something of the order of 20% of the genes that multiple exon genes had alternative transcription start sites. It's probably much bigger. Yeah. So you also get some measure of gene expression and the relative usage of the tags if these things were sampled uniformly. But the millions, you can, I guess you could maybe, but in principle you don't just sequence unique things. You just sequence a whole pool, and then of course the genes that are highly expressed are going to generate more cache tags and so on. Okay, so that was one way of generating diversity. The second way, which I think more people have focused on actually, is alternative splicing. So that's this process over here. So from the DNA, there's a long piece of mRNA that is produced. It's called pre-mRNA. And actually, sort of, to some extent, coupled with transcription, to some extent afterwards, there's a machinery called the spliceosome that comes and removes parts of this long pre-mRNA, which are called introns, and concatenates together the parts that are called exons, and then you end up with an mRNA that looks like this and is translated into a protein. But of course, there's going to be multiple ways of doing this. So in principle, the simplest way you can imagine alternative splicing is you leave out this exon. So for some reason, you don't recognize it as an exon, and then you end up with a mature mRNA that only includes these three pieces. Is going to be shorter, and then depending on what this piece codes for, you can imagine that you can get variations at the protein level in terms of the protein domains that are encoded. How this thing is regulated, so I mentioned at the transcription start site, you can regulate which transcription start site is used dependent on the tissue-specific expression of transcription factors. Something similar happens at the level of splicing, although it's a lot more messy, I think. I don't know if this is just sort of a bias in the, my bias given on what I have worked on. But so the splicing process looks very simply like this. So we have a long pre-mRNA, and then there are some parts of it that will be the exons and some parts of it that are going to be the introns and will be removed. And there's a whole lot of different signals that contribute to the intron-exon definition, and there's different models that are circulating in the field that have to do with, are the exons recognized as exons or are the introns recognized as introns to be removed and so on. But so there are some intronic signals, and those are the splice sites. The branch point, there's a long poly, well, long, there's a polypyrimidine tract between this branch point and the 3' prime, what is called the 3' prime splice site. These things up here are basically the ribonucleoprotein units that bind to the pre-mRNA to be doing the splicing. So there are specific factors that recognize the branch point, the polypyrimidine tract, the 3' prime, 5' prime splice sites that all have to come together in some way to recognize this piece as an intron, and then there's some enzymatic reaction that binds this 5' prime splice site to the branch site and creates this lariat intron, which is then degraded. And what's left out are these exons that will be glued together. And that's how we end up with a mature mRNA. Now, how this process is regulated and how different pieces are recognized as exons in one tissue but not in the other, that's not very well understood. There's a lot of work that has been going on in terms of identifying what are called splice enhancer and silencer sequences, most of which, or at least most of the work has been focused on exons, on identification of mostly exonic splice enhancers. If you read the literature now, it looks like about, you know, if you take something like hexamers or pentamers or octamers, everybody has a different favorite magic number, and roughly like a quarter of these things seem to be doing something to splicing. So it's how exactly it works and how do you get sort of different configurations of exons in different tissues seems like a complicated combinatorial problem. Right. It's a very big number, yeah. Well, actually, so in terms of the octamer, so the one of the studies is coming from Larry Chasen's group. What they've done, basically, they've compared exons with what they call pseudo-exons, the things that look like exons, but they don't seem to be spliced as exons. And basically, the score is just the z-value of the relative frequency of every single motif, octameric motif. And then, you know, you can put, typically what they do is they put some cutoff on these things, and then you report the things that would be, that are overrepresented, that would be your enhancers, that are underrepresented, that would be your exonic splice silencers. And then by using these kind of things, typically sort of the top and bottom motifs, they do reporter assays that, and the tester is basically, you start with a construct gene, and you have an exon, and you put in or you remove the putative enhancer and silencers, and you look at the inclusion ratio of the exon. And in that kind of test, a lot of motifs basically come up as they do something to this ratio.
But this pathway is some kind of, I guess, overexpression, you know, or you're just putting it really as is in the cells.
You take, so the typical construct is you take some mini gene that has like three exons, and the middle exon can be included or excluded. Okay? And then in this exon, you create or you destroy a splice silencer or enhancer motif. And then you look what fraction of the time the exon is included. And typically, you start with something that is included about 50-50, and then you check if your motif is enhancing or decreasing the inclusion rate. Actually, I think that a lot of the stuff is done with cell lines, not so much with just through normal cells.
But are you saying if you would test them the remaining three quarters of all octomers, if you test them in some tissue, you would get lucky?
I mean, the bar is pretty low. I mean, that's how I define version of these words. You have this exon. It's kind of fragile, like bite. For days, you don't even have the time to go down half of the time. Now you make some mutation. You make it optimal occur or not occur. And now the range is no longer 50%, and it's 80-20, right? And then you say, aha, you slightly more. So, I think that, you know, that changing the base function affects this range, the range of 50, maybe, yeah, not so hard, you know, perhaps. Because I find it also hard to believe that three is one quarter of all.
Well, I think it should be said that if you actually look at the motifs that come out, so nobody has actually done this well enough. I mean, so if you look at octomers, you look at all the octomers. So the things that come out that enhances, there is a sequence relationship, namely that if you have some short core motif, everything that is shifted, the shifted variant of that is going to look like an enhancer. This is typically what they report. And if you look at what RNA binding proteins seem to be binding, it's frequently, you know, TNNC, maybe another NN, another base a few nucleotides downstream. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of constraint in terms of what these RNA binding proteins bind. And on the other hand, the model is not worked out well enough to capture these things, so you get a lot of dependent motifs that are all pulled as enhancers, and then you get these numbers.
But you do already have secondary structure right at this point where it's binding to
the. Yes, and there's some stories about, I mean, as with everything else, right, if you want to recognize a motif in an RNA, it has to be somewhat more single-stranded, and there's some people that are doing studies to show that splice enhancer motifs tend to be in single-stranded regions, and I mean, all the stuff, there is basically everything of this nature that you do, and it's kind of common sense, you get a little bit of signal for it. I mean, if you work hard enough, you're going to find it. But how exactly you combine this into predictive modeling is not there. Yeah. Well, that's what I said. I think it's sort of, I mean, everybody's going to give you some arguments. It's going to say, okay, so one of the most sort of sound arguments you can make, well, statistics, if you just have so many exons, you can only look at pentamers, hexamers, whatever. Depends on the size of your data set. But I think a lot of it is just nobody has any clue, and that they have their favorite magic number.
But it's not like the people found, for example, that this is an octamer, and then they expand a bit to see if they have a more significant minor or
There have been some studies where they looked at the motifs of different lengths, but not exactly what you're asking for, or at least I'm not aware of.
But the synonymous position,
yes. Yeah.
But you see that fall off after a few bases, or 9 bases, I guess? Or?
Well, as I said, I don't think anybody has looked at this to figure out at that resolution what the length of the motif is. I'm not even sure you can deconvolve all these different selection pressures to tell, you know, is it 6 or is it 9 for this particular purpose, because it could be overlapping with the motif that is conserved for another reason and so on. Okay, let me see where I am. So, I talked about CAGE. Again, the same group has actually started this before doing the CAGE story. They started to sequence full-length cDNAs. Now, of course, this thing is a lot more tedious. The cDNAs are longer. It takes a longer time to sequence. There are issues associated with, in particular, pulling out and sequencing things that are tens of kilobases long. So there are long cDNAs typically are not captured well by this kind of technology. But some from somewhere around 2000 up to now, or a year ago, they managed to collect data from about 300 libraries, I guess now, and of the order of 100,000 or so full-length cDNAs, from mouse, and there are other efforts to do the same kind of thing in humans. So now with this kind of data, you can start looking at questions about alternative splicing, alternative transcription, things like that. And that's what I try to do, and in particular, to try to put some numbers on all kinds of different things that happen. Actually, so they've supplemented that with about 40,000 curated cDNAs from GenBank, and I think they got to over 20,000 genes, but I don't exactly know the number. Well, okay, so there are issues with what the gene is, but on the other hand, you know, there's not everything is going to merge with everything else in human if you just map these things to the genome. So I think, you know, they probably have good data for about 25,000 genes, I think. I think that's also true now from the newer data sets.
Yeah. How many of the cDNAs cannot be mapped whatsoever?
I don't know the number, but it's not that many. ESTs, with ESTs, it's a lot more problematic. So typically, if you put very stringent filters on the EST mappings, you lose about 40% of all the ESTs in GenBank. But it's not the case with cDNAs. So how do we find alternative splice from this large-scale data? And there's been, I don't even know how many different groups around the world are trying to do some version of this kind of pipeline that I'll tell you about. I'll just talk about the one that we have. And I started to work on, I guess, around 1999 or so. This is what it looks like. Now, our interface to our database of splice variants in a bunch of different species. We've been working mostly in mouse because of this collaboration with the Rican folks, but we also have data for human and fly and, I think, C. elegans. So the questions that we have to solve before we actually can get to analyze splice variants and to say something meaningful about them is to find the splice variants. And these are the steps to do that. So first of all, we do it by mapping transcripts to the genome and inferring gene structures based on these mappings. And that is possible now because we have the human genome sequence, we have the mouse genome sequence, all the model organisms we would want to work with, they have fully sequenced genomes. It wasn't possible at the time when I actually started this. When the human genome was not there, we had to do things like cluster cDNAs based on overlap, pairwise comparisons of the cDNAs, and so on. And there you run into all kinds of problems with paralogous genes and so on that are sort of diminished now when you can map things to the genome. That, of course, assumes that the genome assembly is correct, and issues like paralogs and crazy things and polymorphisms and so on between different organisms that might have been contributed to the sequence are going to make this problem complicated, but for practical purposes, it's better than just having the cDNA data and clustering the cDNA. So one thing we've been working on is on a spliced alignment algorithm to do this mapping of the cDNAs to the genome in a way that we can robustly identify splice boundaries, because, of course, the kind of things we want to do have to do with analyzing splice variants, and we better be able to tell where precisely the splicing boundary is. We infer splice variation then by, once we have all these transcripts mapped to the genome, we start comparing their splice boundaries to identify variations. And one of the sort of trivial but messy problems that we had to deal with is that people had some number of, a list of variations that they were expecting based on molecular biology studies. So there's a notion of skipped exon or cassette exon or what have you, alternative 5' ends, alternative 3' ends, intron inclusion. So these are basically the forms of variations that people describe based on some small number of cases and small number of cDNAs. And as I'll show you in a minute, with hundreds of thousands of cDNAs and with the kind of all the variations that you can see, it's going to be challenging even to describe the variation you see in terms of these simple forms that I mentioned. Mapping transcripts to the genome. So here's a sketch of how our algorithm works. Basically, what we observe is a cDNA. It's represented here in green. And the problem we want to solve is to map this to the genome, meaning that we want to find the places in the genome where individual exons from the cDNA originate in such a way that in between we should see reasonable splicing signals, in particular the 5' and the 3' splice site that I mentioned. So basically the problem is the problem we actually solved is we try to figure out what this transcript is, such that you can account for the cDNA only by sequencing error. So the difference between the transcript, which is the concatenation of these green bars here, exons, the cDNA should differ from this only from only by sequencing errors, and the genome should differ by this inclusion of the introns. So there's some statistical framework that Eric has developed to do this, and we've done it. So practically speaking, there are some issues of implementing this so that you can map millions of ESTs and hundreds of thousands of cDNAs to the genome. So to deal with this problem at this level of magnitude, we had to develop some heuristics, and I'll mention them here. So first of all, you cannot really do the whole dynamic programming solution of mapping a cDNA to the genome because it's just too huge. So we focus on some regions that are most likely to have given rise to the cDNA. And we do that, basically, we're using another cDNA to genome alignment program. It's called BLAT. It's been developed by Jim Kent at UC Santa Cruz. Here's a snapshot of the genome bioinformatics group at UCSC that you might be interested in looking at if you analyze sequence data. Here's their website. One of the things that they have is this BLAT program that they have developed to map cDNAs to the genome. So in the first pass, yeah. You can get a long way doing a text search, because basically what this first step is doing is to try to find, you know, long words that are matching, and then you take some big region there and you try to map your cDNA. So you can do that. But if you really want to find out what the specific introns are and what precisely the splice boundaries are, you have to have a reasonable error model that trades off, for example, mismatches and insertions and things like that, so that you can tell where the splice boundary is. And this you can't really do with the text search. So yeah, you can find a lot of these pieces. You can just take, you know, you can find a lot of the words, but then you have to put the words together into an intron exon structure, and this is where you get the trade-off.
I'm actually surprised now that there is a number that only 2% of the DNA are in the end of the day not mappable.
Yes. No, but even if you say some, you can map, say, maybe 90% of it, I think a lot of the cDNAs you can map. And there's also, I mean, what pieces are missing from the genome, there's also very strong biases in that, right? If you look for the ribosomes, for example, you won't find them because it's hard to assemble these things. But for protein-coding genes of whatever composition, which is not completely GC-rich and heterochromatic and I don't know what, then the assembly is reasonable. And where are the errors in the assembly? Of course, maybe the gene, but maybe the precise order of the genes is not correct, but for a particular gene, is it wrong? Or can you really not get 90% of it in one sort of contiguous bit? Okay. So what we do is, again, sort of this kind of text search that he mentioned before to find the most promising regions where we can map the cDNA. Then we extract all these candidate loci, and then we map using our scoring model the cDNA to the genome. And we do this for every particular locus candidate. And at the end, we take all the mappings that we obtained, and we take the highest scoring one as the locus from which the cDNA originates. One thing that we try to do is to, so I'll show you in a minute a bit of a comparison with other mapping programs, but we try to map as much as we can, and we do this sort of in a hierarchical fashion. So for efficiency purposes, we start with big word sizes. We try to identify pieces that match perfectly to the genome that are relatively long. But if we can, if there's some region of the cDNA that doesn't map like that, then we decrease this word size and do this in a recursive fashion until we reach some limit or we manage to map more of the cDNA.
I'm sorry, just to get a feel for that. So the more connected
well, that depends on how your scores are going to look like. Right. Yeah. So what is the trade-off between? So you could, in principle, generate a gene structure if you take every former and you find the perfect match for it, and for it, and then you make a contiguous. So in particular, these kind of exons you're talking about, 3-4 nucleotides, they virtually, I think maybe there's two known examples of such things. So you would not get them in a, I mean, they're probably. Okay, so we do this, and then just to show you how it works compared to other kinds of methods. So actually, when we started developing this, I think the only programs that were available were SIM4, and then BLAT came along, and basically these other things came up later, in particular GMAP, sort of right before we finished our mapping program. So what you see here is, so of course, now you want to compare the mappings you get with different programs. And this in itself is a problem because you don't really know the right answer. So we try to figure out some objective measures of how well these programs do. In particular, you know, how many nucleotides you cannot match or are not matched at all by a particular program. How many nucleotides are in ends that are not mapped by different programs. Because it turns out that different programs have different biases and they fail to recognize different kinds of things. Splice boundary errors or unknown splice boundaries. By that I mean, so there are two spliceosomes and there's three splice signals that are recognized, and they're basically the vast majority of introns have either a GT5 prime AG3 prime boundary or a GCAG or a ATAC. So these are the most frequent splice boundaries that you find. So in this picture, our algorithm is shown with this red line, and all the errors that are made by these other algorithms are scaled relative to the SPA error rate. So as you can see, you know, we've done our best to do better across the board in terms of the kind of errors that we make. And depending on, you know, on the algorithm, they tend to have different biases and tend to make different kinds of errors. This most recent program, which is called GMAP, is very popular because, for one thing, it's extremely fast, and it's actually quite good. One thing that it doesn't do is really when it runs into a region of errors, it just tends not to map the transcript, and in particular to drop the ends. So you can see these things if you look carefully at this picture. Also, you can read a bit about the biases of these different algorithms if you look at the relative frequency of different kinds of splice boundaries that we observe. So as I said, the most frequent are GTAG, GCAG, ATAC. In our scheme, ATAC comes as the fifth most frequent, and there are a lot of strange-looking splice boundaries that look related to each other, and we found some bias for what tissues these kind of things happen, and we think that the splicing process might be messed up in particular kinds of tumor cells from which the cDNAs have been isolated, and then you get these kind of splice boundaries. I won't spend too much time on this, I guess. I'll just show you one slide with examples of where actually these kind of scoring models make a difference in the kinds of splice boundaries that we see. So we've done a comparison of our program compared to BLAT, and we looked at three cases where there is a difference in the mapping. And you probably can see this because I can't see it myself. So there are cases in which, for example, there are non-canonical splice boundaries that we identify, and the mapping that we get is perfect all the way to the splice boundary, and BLAT is trying to impose a canonical splice boundary, and that it can only do with some errors at the boundary. In some cases, it's really bad. It can create a whole shift in a repetitive region for some reason I actually don't understand. And the same sort of thing applies here. Okay, so once we've done this, we went through this exercise, we mapped the cDNA to the genome, we end up with a picture that looks something like this. So here's the genome. The black boxes are the mapped exons that are part of the cDNA, and the red line through these boxes corresponds to the introns, which are not part of the cDNA, so they were missing. Okay, so you end up with a picture like this. Now find out the splice variants and what kind of splice variants you have. So you have to have some annotation process that classifies these things in some way. And I'll tell you what we do. So basically we look at three kinds of simple variation. So first of all, we look whether the exon is constitutive or alternative, and that means constitutive, it is present in all the mRNAs that traverse the region where the exon is mapped. So these exons, the green ones, are constitutive exons. This exon with the bar around this is an alternative exon. It's only present in some of the transcript that go through this region, but not all. We look at things like this, the splice site variation. So does a particular exon have a variation at the 5' end, at the 3' end, or at both ends? And another dimension is, does the exon contain is there an intron inclusion in this exon? Now, of course, I said exon, but you could imagine that you'd ask yourself, what is an exon if you just line these things up and you see cases like this where you have two non-contiguous pieces mapped to this region, whereas in this case, the whole contiguous piece is mapped to this region. How do you define exons? And there is no sort of universal answer to this, and I don't think there's a right answer. But the way we define an exon is we take the union of all the pieces that overlap in some single linkage clustering scheme with a particular genomic region. Okay, so we moved from the picture that I had before with the black boxes and unannotated exons to a picture that looks like this, which is a bit more colorful and maybe tells you something about what kind of variation we see. So in particular here, the yellow color represents variation at this particular exon end. The blue color represents variation at the 5' end of the exon. The black boxes, which I don't have, yeah. Yes, I do have here, that represent alternative exons. Now, I put this up because it's a particularly difficult thing to deal with computationally. And this, so it's a co-transcribed cluster of genes. So there's actually three genes in this cluster here. This gene structure has been discovered and described in 2002. And you can get actually transcripts that go through this entire region that are polycistronic. So they encode for multiple proteins. something that is not very common to in particular in mammals and has not been very much described before. Yeah, this is exactly how they overlap. So if you have something like this, as Eric was mentioning before, what do you call a gene? So what we typically do when we identify a gene is we take, you know, this is the boundary of this transcript in the genome, and these are the boundaries of this transcript in the genome, and these are the boundaries of this transcript in the genome. If they overlap, then you'll say, well, they probably come from the same gene, and you can qualify it a bit more and require that the overlap is really in an exonic piece that really codes for a protein, because you would, I mean, a gene should be coding more or less for a protein or variants of a protein. But now if you have something like this, there are really three proteins, and you don't have a computational way to distinguish, you know, should you separate this? I mean, does this exon really belong to the hyaluronidase gene, or does it, this form of it belong to the N-acetyltransferase when you see it in a transcript of this type? Yeah. I don't know off the top of my head, but I imagine they are because they're fairly long and they have to code. So
you're just showing coding?
No. I know. I have the coding regions marked on another picture, but they're not here. But so I don't remember if this particular exon is coding or not. If it is coding, it must be in the same frame because it's relatively long in this. Yeah, this, so this one is not so much. Yes. Okay, so as I said, this is a bit of an extreme example, but if you take all the STs into account and they look at how they line up in the genome, what kind of exons you get a lot of exons that, you know, the known genes and sort of the mRNAs that come from the genes don't have. There's a lot of papers recently that claim there's a lot of evolution of new exons, in particular through the recruitment of repeat elements. And then you could ask yourself, well, if you do get these kind of things, are they going to be in frame or not? Most likely they're not going to be in frame. So the message that that I'm conveying here is that there's a zoo out there. And basically, if you look at the numbers of genes, so the fraction of genes that have multiple splice forms, this is a number that I've estimated in 2003 based on some limited data, but turns out to be fairly close to what is known now, and slightly less than what is known in human. More than half of the mouse and human genes have multiple splice forms, so this seems to be the rule in mammals. Of course, the next question is how much of this variation is functional? So everywhere that I've given a talk about this kind of thing is asking this question. So the problem is we don't really know how to distinguish functional from non-functional, in particular after some number of papers that claim that transcripts with stops in the open reading frame that in principle don't code for the protein because they're targeted by nonsense-mediated decay. That particular splicing event that introduces the in-frame stop codon is regulated in such a way that basically generate a non-functional variant on purpose to turn off the gene in some way that is completely roundabout rather than just not transcribe the gene. Because of things like this, we can't really say which of these transcripts are functional and which ones are not. But I just want to give you two examples that we've worked on, cases in which we think that the variation is functional and cases in which we think it's just noise. So the case in which we think there is some interesting issue of functionality, it's basically examples like this, where if you look at all the transcripts that originate from a given locus, and here's you see the multiplicity of this. So this eight times we have observed a variant that looks like this. And this is just, I've truncated this the transcripts over here because the interesting region is this one. So what you can see here is that there is an exon. It actually occurs in multiple forms. It has a 5' end variation. And this exon is included only in the transcripts that have downstream transcription start sites. but it is not included in the transcripts that start further upstream. And this, a similar case is here. These are basically two different genes. This cassette of two exons is included when the transcription start site is here, but not when it is there. So the question that we wanted to ask is, can we actually find internal exons whose inclusion-exclusion pattern depends on the transcription start site that has been used in the transcript? So what we've done is basically we started with this picture, and we tabulated. So we numbered all the promoters that are available for the transcription of this gene, and we counted how many times the exon has been included or excluded with this, with each particular promoter. So promoter one, there is only one transcript, and that doesn't include the exon, so the exon is excluded, no times included. And we make a table like this, and then we make another model where we basically say, we want to distinguish between two models. One is one in which the inclusion rate is dependent on the promoter, so there's a probability P that the exon is included, and that P varies for different promoters, or a model in which the P is independent of the promoters, just one for the particular gene. So we can go do this calculation, and what we estimate at the end is the fraction of, this fraction F, of promoter-dependent exons. And that fraction for mouse in this case is around 15%. This is what you observe for randomized data sets. So at least 10 to 15% of all the internal exons that are sometimes included, sometimes not, have some evidence of association with the promoters. Yes. I'll get to that. Okay. So that was the question, right? So is there some evidence that these things are closer to the promoter? So it's actually not completely trivial how to look at this, and I'll show you sort of two ways in which I've looked at this. So first of all, you can calculate, given the exon, like the one you have here, you can look at the average distance to the promoter that caused the inclusion of the exon. I'm going to use this sort of causality in a very loose sense, right? So with this promoter and this promoter and this promoter and this promoter, the exon is included. And with these other promoters, the exon is excluded. So you can look at the average distance when the exon is excluded and the average distance to promoter when the exon is included. You can ask the question is, what I asked is, for the exons that have evidence of association with promoter, so for every exon, we put the posterior probability that it is associated with the promoter. We take the top and the bottom of these cases, and we call those promoter-dependent, promoter-independent exons. And the red line shows you the promoter-dependent, and the black line shows you the promoter-independent exons. And you can ask the minimum distance to a promoter, either when included or when excluded. Is that different between the promoter-dependent and independent? And what you can see here is that clearly the ones that are promoter-dependent are closer to one of the promoter types, the including one or the excluding ones. But what you can say, so just focus now again on the red lines, you cannot say that it is included with the promoter that is closest or excluded with the promoter that is closest. So there is no such rule like that. And actually, so these examples that I showed at the beginning, the inclusion is with the closer promoter, but there's also plenty of examples where you get exclusion with the closer promoter. So these are really two different exons. And when this transcription start site is used with this initial exon, this exon here, the little one, is not included. So we cannot say that the promoter tends to be closer when the exon is included or excluded, but one of the two promoters, on average, is closer to that exon if there is a dependency. So the second, how much time do I actually have?
So let's maybe go for 20 questions.
Okay. I can do that. Okay, so the second type of examples I want to show is those examples in which I think if we look at the splice variation, it is mostly due to noise in the splicing process.
I'm sorry, but we have plenty of time also in the upcoming week or the week after, so you can also fill in something to later configuration of this one. So it may be better to.
I'll just leave it at some sort of round point, and then we see what that is going to be depending on how fast I go. Okay, so a case in which I think the splice variation that we observe in the sequence data is mostly due to a noisy splicing process. So what you see here is a picture that I've drawn a few years ago. This is a histogram of the distance between alternative splice sites, in which the splice sites are either donor splice sites here and acceptor splice sites here. And this is sort of nucleotide resolution picture. So these are really the frequency with which you observe 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, nucleotide shifts between the different variants. One thing to note is that there is a lot of small variation. And I should say that I've selected this data set such that the both of these exons have a perfectly mapped piece of at least 10 nucleotides from either side of the splice junction, so there's not many ways of shifting these splice sites around. So they're as solid as I can get them, and still there's a lot of small variation. Now, you can imagine on the protein level, unless there is a frame shift, that small exon variation is not going to make a big difference. So what causes all these variations and why are they so frequent? So how frequent they are? Well, 10 nucleotides and less, it's about 18% of all the variation that we've seen for the donor splice sites. It's actually 40% of all the acceptor splice site variation that we observe. And in particular, at the acceptor splice site, we have this horrendous peak of precisely 3 nucleotides that accounts for most of the variation that we see at the acceptor splice site. So this looks intriguing, and a lot of people have started to look at this, and in particular, to come up with evidence for why 3 nucleotide variations are important for fine-tuning the proteome and changing one amino acid in a protein in such a way that you change the functionality of the protein. We've taken a different approach, precisely because we've seen these things are very frequent, and also frame-shifting variations are very frequent, not just these 3 nucleotide variations. So here's what we've done. First of all, we've used the Recon data to tell variation in the coding region, variation in the 3', 5' UTR, and variation in what to our best ability, look like non-coding transcripts. So that means these are transcripts from clusters of transcripts in which no transcript has an annotated coding region, right? So we've made these clusters of overlapping transcripts, sort of genes, and we've identified non-coding genes because none of the transcripts that come from them have a decent open reading frame. So this we call non-coding transcripts. And if you look at the variation, so what the y-axis shows here is the fraction of multiple of 3 in frame, so to speak, variation. And if you look at the variation at the acceptor splice sites and variation at the donor splice site, as you might expect, in coding regions, there is an enrichment for in-frame variation, which is just due to some process that weeds out the out-of-frame transcripts. But if you look at UTR exons and non-coding exons, at the acceptor splice sites, you also see an enrichment of variations of multiples of 3. Now, this looks weird because it cannot possibly have something to do with the coding potential of the transcript. We did another thing, which is we took variations that are relatively large, longer than 4 nucleotides. And what you see if you compare this picture with this picture is that in the UTRs and non-coding transcripts, you don't get to see this bias for multiples of 3. So that is really just due to these variations of precisely 3 nucleotides at the acceptor splice sites that you can see in coding regions as well as in non-coding regions. They are not due to some strange sequence bias. So if you take any boundary of an exon and you look at where the acceptor splice sites or pseudo-acceptor splice sites, AGs, occur, there is no bias for multiples of 3 that we can identify. And in particular, there's no significant difference between coding regions and UTRs. So there must be something else. So to figure out what accounts for this, the first thing we wanted to do is, well, the transcripts that we observe are, so these are cDNAs that have been produced from mRNAs that were in the cell, and they somehow survived long enough to be captured in the cDNA libraries. So first of all, what we had to do is to try to figure out how much in-frame, out-of-frame variation has been produced by the splicing process, in particular, before the nonsense-mediated decay process that removes the out-of-frame transcript operated. So we did another little model. Basically, all we have to do is to adjust the fraction so we have an observed fraction of in-frame variations. We started with something, and some fraction of the out-of-frame variance has been removed by the nonsense-mediated decay process. So we want to estimate this fraction F, and we want to estimate what fraction of transcripts are in-frame, out-of-frame, before NMD operated. So we do this little calculation just for sort of general interest. It looks like, at least in the Recon data, slightly more than half of the transcripts that have frame shifts have not been removed by the nonsense-mediated decay. So the efficiency of this process, as reflected in the cDNA data from Recon, is less than 50%. I haven't done this, but there is it's a fairly large data set, so the variation is not humongous. Right. There's many, many exons. Okay, so the estimate is robust. And it should be said that, coming back to the issue of the biases in this data has been collected in some way for some purpose. And I'm not going to claim that this is really the NMD rate in the cell, because in particular, if you enrich for unique transcripts, you're going to have all kinds of weird things. So presumably, it's an underestimation of the NMD efficiency. But if you talk to people that are doing these things in the lab, you also hear a number that is roughly of the order of 80%, but not nowhere near 99%. Okay, so now we go back and try to look at these numbers. So what we did is we said, okay, so we have to explain these small shifts of up to 4 nucleotide variations at the acceptor splice sites. So let's do a model of what the spliceosome recognizes. So what we did is we took invariant exons, and we constructed weight matrix models of the sequence specificity of the spliceosome at the splice boundary. So these are the relative frequencies with which we observe ACGs and Ts at different positions around the splice site. And with this model, we could try to predict what is the frequency with which you observe shifts of 1, 2, 3, 4 nucleotides at the splice boundary, given a splice boundary and all the sequence around it. Okay? So this is what we get. So what you can see here is that given this model and the sequence around acceptor splice sites, 3 nucleotide variations are clearly much more frequent than any other at the acceptor splice sites. And if you compare this with what you actually observe in the data, this is what you see. And this apparently also holds for the donor splice sites, although there is a bit of a difference between variations of 1 and 4 nucleotides, which has some explanation we know about. But as far as predictive models in things like splicing, I think that this correspondence between the predicted frequencies of variation and the observed ones is quite astounding. And if this were the case, then we should be able to predict, given a splice boundary, and we look at all the variants of a particular gene, we should predict with what frequency every kind of 1, 2, 3 nucleotide variations is observed in the real data. Let me just finish this and then I'll end. So we use the same kind of framework And this is what you see. So if we take the real data and then we have splice variants, and then we look what is the difference in likelihood of the two boundaries that are being used in the splicing process. So this is the difference in the log likelihood. And then what we show here on the y-axis is the fraction with which one or the other splice boundary is observed. And the take-home message of this is, so this is real observed variation. If the first site has much higher likelihood than the second site, then splicing will occur at the first splice site. If the second site has a much higher likelihood than the first splice site, then the second splice site will be used by the spliceosome. And the blue line that you probably don't see very well here is cases in which the alternative splice sites are very close in likelihood. And for those, basically, either of the splice boundaries is used equally often. So this is as close as we can come up with a predictive model of where the splicing will occur given a particular piece of sequence. Of course, you can say, well, this is happening around known splice sites, around splice sites that we know are functional, right? So if you were to take a genome sequence and use this weight matrix model and try to predict splices, you won't get anywhere, obviously. But given a boundary that is more or less that is used, and you look in the neighborhood of it, what kind of variation you could expect to observe in the cDNA data, you can pretty much predict that based on this weight matrix model. Yeah.
What happens when you go out to find
we haven't done the same kind of framework to try to explain those things, but what happens? Okay, what happens in terms of what exactly?
I mean, you had a really nice plot on the previous slide.
Yes.
So
does it hold for these other ones? At some point, so as I said, the model we have in our heads right now is that you have a set of signals that define a splice site. And then the spliceosome somehow assembles there, and it can wobble to some extent and move from the sort of shift around, and it finds a position and it cuts. And that sort of shifting around is restricted by this affinity model, right? But if you move a little bit, if you move far enough, then this is not going to hold because it's not sort of really the neighborhood of one splice site, but it's really a whole new splice site. And you try to estimate now the relative frequency of usage of two different splice sites. And I don't know exactly how well this works. We haven't done the same thing to look how it varies with the distance. Yeah. Yes. Well, it depends on who you ask. Most people will tell you sort of, yeah, it's all very complicated. Weight matrices are no good and so on. But actually, if you go back and look at like GenScan, and so Chris Birch has looked at this kind of thing to do gene prediction, and the model that he's used for the splice site is some hierarchy of weight matrices. So he's done a dependency analysis, and so he's looked if you have G at a particular position, then you have some set of weight matrices. If you don't have a G, then you have some other set of weight matrices. But it's still a set of weight matrices. As I said, if you try to predict splice sites in a naked genome sequence, obviously you won't get anywhere just with a weight matrix. But in the context of other signals, and maybe you make it slightly more fancy and you have sets of weight matrices depending on what you have at precise positions to account for dependencies between different positions in the weight matrix, which obviously are not captured here, then it looks like you can predict it.
But once it puts it there, the binding affinity of the splice cell to things around that position, I think the way that you know is actually
right.
Because you can make it clear. But
basically, the one that comes by that you have a preference for RNA.
and one thing is, and you want to estimate more complicated models, then you have to be able to do that with the data that you have. And you can make this thing arbitrarily complicated. Okay, so let me try to end here. And there's one thing that I wanted to say that still has to do with the splice, well, transcript diversity, basically. And that is the last part that I was going to tie into the story with the microRNAs, but I'll just tell you the punchline. Okay, so I told you before that there's this whole diversity of transcription start sites and polyadenylation sites, right? Now, from those of you that are familiar with microRNAs, you probably know that they tend to target the 3' UTRs of transcripts. And it's a no-brainer that if you have alternative 3' UTRs, you expect different kinds of targeting, different transcripts of a gene to be targeted by different sets of microRNAs, right? So that's what we've looked at. So first of all, what Demos, my student, has been looking at is the location of microRNA, predicted microRNA target sites in transcripts. And what you see here is this holds for humans, for human UTRs that can get quite long, sometimes up to 10 kilobases or so. And what you see here is a heat map of the position of the microRNA, predicted microRNA target sites in the UTR. So this is the length of the UTR. And this is the relative location of the microRNA target site in the UTR of a specified length. So what you can notice here is that for the long UTRs, microRNA target sites tend to be located at the beginning or at the end of the 3' UTR. Of course, you can ask yourself, I mean, most target prediction methods that people believe are successful use cross-species conservation, and for some odd reason or another, it looks like the beginning and the end of the 3' UTR are more conserved. So you'd expect to predict more sites there, yeah. Well, I'll show you in this one. So if you actually project this thing, okay, so what I wanted to say, but it holds very much for the microRNA. So we've done these things with microRNA target sites, and we've done these things for siRNA off-target sites. So there's data that uses siRNAs. You look at the transcripts that go up and down depending on your manipulation, and you can look at where the predicted siRNA binding site is. And you get the same kind of picture for UTRs that are longer than 2,000 or so nucleotides. They tend to go at the beginning and at the end of the UTR, and you can see that this difference is maybe a factor of two. Okay? Right. You get a very similar picture. Okay, so now, of course, if you have different polyadenylation sites, your UTR is going to change. This is going to make a difference. And actually, we've done predictions of microRNA target sites in alternative 3' UTRs that have been inferred by some other group on ensemble transcripts. So what you see here are different 3' UTRs of the ARGO2 gene, which is a component of the RISC machinery, which is basically using microRNAs for translation inhibition. So there's three different UTRs, and as you can see, these are the locations of predicted target sites in it. There's, between this and this, there's obviously a lot of difference in what kind of microRNAs are predicted to target these UTRs. So the bottom line here is that we started with splicing. You can get alternative transcription start site, alternative termination, and this somehow has to do with the protein that is going to change the protein that is encoded by the transcript, but it actually can have a lot of other different effects, including changing the targetability of the transcript or the gene by microRNAs. And I'm going to stop here.